The counterculture movement associated with the 1960s and 70s had many antecedents. Henry David Thoreau was born in 1817 and died almost 45 years later. Two of his best-known works are Walden and Civil Disobedience, originally published as Resistance to Civil Government. Walt Whitman was born in 1819 and lived until 1892. He's remembered for his pioneering poem, Leaves of Grass. He also coined the apothegm, Resist Much, Obey Little. Thoreau and Whitman are but two of the many who fomented in favor of counterculture, a river of resistance fed by many tributaries that included the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Panther Movement, the Chicano Movement, the Women's Liberation Movement, the American Indian Movement, and a great stream of consciousness and activism that continues to persist, the modern environmental movement. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Loeffler. In 1968, Edward Abbey's book Desert Solitaire was released. In that book, Abbey both expressed his deep love for the natural environment and his rage against the construction of the Glen Canyon Dam that stoppered the Colorado River and formed Lake Powell that drowned Glen Canyon, regarded by many as one of the most beautiful natural habitats in the world. In 1969 and 1970, counterculturalists in New Mexico began to gather in small groups to try to stop the kind of air pollution that emanated from the coal-fired Four Corners power plant situated near Shiprock, New Mexico. We heard scuttlebutt about a proposed coal strip mine scheduled for Black Mesa in northern Arizona, located in the heart of Hopi and Navajo country. We gathered what information we could, and then I went to visit my old friend David Manonya at his home in Hope Villa in Hopi country and told him what we'd learned. He asked me to join him the following day on Second Mesa, where he'd assembled 63 Hopi elders. I told them that the Peabody Coal Company of East St. Louis had signed contracts with the Hopi Tribal Council and the United States government that would allow Peabody to strip mine vast amounts of coal from Black Mesa to fire up a power plant to be constructed near the shores of Lake Powell. I also told them that Peabody would pump water at the rate of 2,000 gallons a minute from the Pleistocene aquifer beneath Black Mesa to slurry coal to another power plant near Bullhead City, Nevada. The Hopis were enraged, and after a period of discussion, they asked me to help them get this information out to the American public to attempt to halt this entire operation. I went back to Santa Fe, and Jimmy Hopper, Bill Brown, Terry Moore, and I started the Black Mesa Defense Fund. For the better part of the next 3 years, we gave it our best shot. We worked closely with the Native American Rights Fund to try to legally stop this debacle. We publicized it on radio and TV, wrote articles for many publications, and delivered lectures at colleges and universities across America. But we'd taken on the Central Arizona Project, and it would take more than a handful of Hopis, hippies, and traditional Navajos to stop a landmark collaboration between the world of corporate America and the United States government in their determination to turn the habitat of the American Southwest into money. The Central Arizona Project, also known as the CAP, is regarded by many as the greatest environmental debacle to have ever befallen the North American Southwest. For years, attorney Charles Wilkinson worked with the Native American Rights Fund, whose legal staff worked closely with Hopi and Navajo Indians to thwart the strip mining of coal on land sacred to both tribes by the Peabody Coal Company of East St. Louis. His passion in behalf of his Native American friends is enduring.
You've got to have the CAP. And that was not only non-negotiable, but non-discussable. That means you had to have another power source. And the, quote, logical place, as indisputable really as it originally was simply to dam the Grand Canyon, now the simple solution was the great world-class coal deposit under Black Mesa. Black Mesa had obstacles that should have been as obvious and as important as the distance and the gradient of the CAP itself, but they weren't. What the obstacles should have been but weren't were that this is the Hopi's ancestral land, a deeply traditional tribe in one of the most remote areas in the lower 48, living in their own way and deeply connected to Black Mesa. It is a very complicated matter to scour out the coal bed and create one of the largest, if not the largest, coal mining facility in the world, and then send the coal to two different power plants. One, the Mojave over in Nevada, would be used for electricity generally. The coal would be shipped also north to Page, where Navajo Generating Station would be built to provide the electricity for the CAP, which was far to the south, but with the power grid that had been built up during the big buildup, that was of no consequence. That, quote, simple formula, use Black Mesa coal, ship it north to Navajo Generating Station, use that electricity for the CAP, should have been profoundly complicated for us, because you're tearing up Hopi land, you're tearing up old villages, sacred sites. You're then sending it to a coal-fired power plant that was going to foul the skies, the Hopi skies, and everyone else's skies. It got even more tangled and even more dark because of the way that the Hopi lease with Peabody Coal was negotiated.
Shanto Begay is a Navajo man who has spent much of his life on and around Black Mesa in his home landscape. Shanto is a great artist and poet who reads his poem,
My grandfather's prayer is disturbed. In the morning he walks slowly out the door, sadness upon his once strong face. With a slow gait he walks towards the east. The blazing sun rises behind the coal mine upon the mesa. The air smells of smoke, not from cook fires. The trampled ground littered with bottles and papers, souvenirs of ceremonies two nights before. My grandfather's prayer is disturbed. The wind that carries his pollen lightly hangs, heavy. Trucks on the distant highway blare their impatience. Boughs on pinions and junipers are parched brown. The rain clouds have abandoned us this summer. The watering holes have dried up. Up on the mesa, machines big as buildings, machines like he's never seen, continue to rip into the earth. My grandfather's prayers is disturbed. The yearly sky already slashed with jet streams, threads of white from which no water falls. Lightning flash of light from jet far above mocks the thirsty earth. The roar follows far behind, laws of nature distorted. My grandfather's prayer is disturbed. The ground rumbles slightly as a coal train picks another load away. Explosives shake the mesa as new veins are opened. The mesa will be smaller this evening. My prayers are disturbed. Still we sprinkle pollen for another day. Still we have faith.
For decades, my great friend Ed Abbey and I hiked for thousands of miles through the magnificent landscape of the North American Southwest. We camped in countless beautiful campsites where we'd spend as long as 2 weeks at a time, allowing ourselves to integrate as best we could into the spirit of each particular place. In 1975, Edward Abbey's seminal novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, was published and has now inspired two generations of so-called radical environmentalists. On January the 1st, 1983, I recorded Edward Abbey as we returned from a camping trip in the Superstition Mountains of southern Arizona.
I suppose if political means fail us, public organization, and public pressure, if those don't do what has to be done, then we'll be driven to more extreme defensive measures in defending our Mother Earth. Well, here in the United States, I can see a lot more acts of civil disobedience beginning to occur as the bulldozers and the drilling rigs attempt to move into the wilderness and into the backcountry and the farmlands and seashores and other precious places. And if civil disobedience is not enough, I imagine there will be sabotage, violence against machinery, property, Those are pretty desperate measures. If that becomes widespread, it could be that the battle has already been lost. I don't know what would happen beyond that. That might possibly stimulate some sort of police state reaction, repression, a real military-industrial dictatorship in this country. But still, personally, I feel that when all other means fail, as a last resort, we are morally justified, and not merely justified, but morally obligated to defend that which we love by whatever means are available. Just as if my family, my wife, or my children were attacked, I wouldn't hesitate to use violence to defend them. By the same principle, if land I love is being violated, raped, plundered, murdered, and all political means to save it have failed, I personally feel that sabotage is morally justifiable, at least if it does any good, if it'll help, if it will only help you to feel good.
Just for the record, one of the things that's obviously going to occur should sabotage become a necessity on the part of some people reacting to everything that has been perpetrated on our culture, I would hazard that some would call acts of physical sabotage terrorism.
The distinction seems quite clear and simple to me. Sabotage is an act of force or violence against property or machinery in which life is not endangered or should not be. Terrorism, on the other hand, is violence against living things, human beings, and other living things. That kind of terrorism is generally practiced by governments against their own people, against their own citizens. We have that kind of terrorism going on right now in much of Latin America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and quite recently in Argentina and Chile, and a mild form of it in Poland during the past year. The Soviets are committing terrorism against the people of Afghanistan right now, with limited success, I'm happy to hear. Our government committed great acts of terrorism against the people of Vietnam quite recently. That's what terrorism means to me. Violence and the threat of violence against human beings and other forms of life, which seems quite different, radically different from sabotage, which is a much more limited tactic. I'd go so far as to say that a bulldozer tearing up a hillside, ripping out trees for the purpose of a logging operation or a strip mine is committing a kind of terrorism against life.
Earth First is remembered as one of the most effective radical environmental groups in the history of the modern environmental movement. I recorded another old friend, Dave Foreman, a founder of Earth First, who has dedicated his life to the preservation of wilderness.
I've come to the conclusion that the most effective way to stop this industrial juggernaut is for people individually, acting in true American fashion, to go out and resist it. And you can resist it nonviolently without danger to yourself or other people, but you can stop it. That if you go in and properly pull up survey stakes or help erosion wash out roads that shouldn't be there, that sooner or later the Forest Service and other agencies are going to realize that they can't maintain that really expensive infrastructure of roads. And just a number of things like this will eventually cause the retreat of industrial civilization for millions of acres. That in effect we can create our own de facto wilderness and cause civilization to stay away. And I visualize this as simple self-defense of the wilderness. That, hey, we aren't subversive, we aren't trying to overthrow any system, we're just saying hands off. Don't come into these wild areas, leave them alone. That we're the grizzly, we're the wolf, we're the spotted owl, we're the ponderosa pine, we're the creosote bush, practicing self-defense. I do not see any way possible for the current trend to keep going, that sooner or later things are going to have to crash. I think we're in a car going 90 miles an hour down a dead-end street with a brick wall right in front of us, and we're trying to look for the brakes, and I don't think there are any.
On Black Mesa, which is also known as Big Mountain, the United States Congress passed a bill that would result in the relocation of thousands of Navajo Indians, essentially making land jointly used by both Hopi and Navajo Indians, more accessible to resource extraction by giant corporations. Traditional Hopis and Navajos had united against the Peabody Coal Company, but their attempts were ever thwarted by legislation that favored corporate access to lands that had been inhabited by indigenous peoples for at least 7,000 years. Roberta Blackgoat lived on Big Mountain in an area where up to 10,000 Navajos faced relocation because of political interference by figures in the United States government, whose economic interests often subsumed their interest in indigenous members of their constituencies.
This place is the big sacred spots right here, where they're going to make a sand painting, and if they wanted to have prayers, and where are they going to put the Indian baskets. This is the main spot right here. We can't take these baskets or medicines on either side of this sacred mountain. This is a special spot. All these big mountain and Navajo mountain or four sacred mountains, they sent words, news or something like that to these sacred mountains. Whatever is happening out here in these sacred mountains, there's a medicine man that uses prayers. And then the winds sent the message to these four main sacred mountains. This is how we always say we hate to have this mountain to be destroyed. Because it talks like us in their way, just like the trees when the wind, it breezes and you could hear the sounds of it. And even the grasses or whatever the herbs are, they talking to each other by whispering, or they might be praying or they might be singing. That's the sound that we hear. If they are destroyed, we can't use any medicine out of it. Of course, we use medicine and foods or whatever. These plants are with us. And some are medicine, some are food. And if illness comes around to a person, then we use some strong herbs for it. And they're growing around among us. And here a lot of things has been plan on this area, that's the mine or uranium or oil, whatever comes up, and they're going to start destroying our medicines. This is the main point that we can't give up. As long as I'm here, I'm not going to give up. According to our old ancestors, they said, don't ever give up. There's something gonna happen. It's gonna be ruined someday. Or either you're gonna be shot or whatever it's gonna, you're gonna be destroyed first and then they're gonna destroy the land.
My cousin Richard Groh had been active in the Black Power movement in Detroit before moving to the Bay Area in the 1970s. His day gig was as an engineer for the Environmental Protection Agency in San Francisco. But he was and remains committed to activism in the counterculture movement. He befriended members of the American Indian Movement in Oakland and ultimately Roberta Blackgoat on Big Mountain. For years, his home in Berkeley served as the Bay Area Big Mountain support group. Richard tells of being invited by Roberta Blackgoat to confront bulldozers on Big Mountain.
We got down there, we spent days hanging around. They did some ceremony over us to get us all in the right place to go out and confront the bulldozers, and it all came down on exactly the right day. And we all got indicted, and there was a trial that was going to happen and all of that, and which was fascinating over the course of from January, February into March, with a really fairly dramatic scene in the courtroom where they're getting ready to, the feds are bringing their case to really, they wanted to put us all away for 5 years for crossing state lines to, it was federal crime. It turned out what we did, which was one of the most grounded things we'd done, I mean, literally at the request of the elders, and then prep was ceremony among the elders and hand tremblers and folks like that. caused so much confusion among the non-Indian movement and among the Indian movement itself. The theme in the air for us political lefty folks was called solidarity. And solidarity meant there's real homegrown revolutionary stuff going on, whether it's in Nicaragua, El Salvador, or at Big Mountain. Solidarity means that you non-folks, especially you Anglo folks, it's time you took responsibility for dealing with your government's role in screwing this up. So that's how we understood our Big Mountain work, was it's not time for us to go be Indians or El Salvadorians or Nicaraguans. It's time for us to challenge our own government to get right with these people we're screwing over. You, go deal with your government and get them off our back. So it was a clean piece of work. The expression we used, you knew it back then, was to take your direction from the elders, from the indigenous leadership. Again, whether it's in Nicaragua, El Salvador, or Big Mountain. And it helped that there was these hard-ass movement folks in AIM. They put out a pretty militant message. You will respect our elders and our people, or you're not welcome here. You know, the people down there on the land at the time, there were armed confrontations going on and off all the time. Our role wasn't to go join them, but was to educate our society, our culture, as to what that's about.
The Hopi Indians and their ancestors have inhabited their homeland for countless generations, according to their mythic history. Lyle Bolenqua tells of what it means to him to be a Hopi.
We as Hopi, how we've come to be who we are is a direct result of the land that we have inhabited. We chose the place that we ultimately ended up because it was hard, because it was a harsh landscape. There's multiple stories out there about how Hopi came to be where they're at now. But it was with the understanding that we live in a desert landscape, that to make a living there was going to test one's physical, spiritual, emotional side of yourself and really push you to understand the intricate fluctuations, I guess, of living in such a landscape. It's not guaranteed that it's going to rain every year or snow every winter. For Hopi, our natural landscape, our habitat, has directly influenced our lifestyle, our traditional lifestyle. Of course, we're impacted now by modern society just as everyone else is, but the core foundation, what Hopi is supposed to stand for, is to not forget what it takes to live in that landscape. All of our ceremonies, or a good portion of them, are centered around that idea of moisture, bringing moisture, asking moisture to come. You know, it's that different kind of cultural perspective of, well, it's not weather patterns, it's not the jet stream bringing clouds and moisture and the changing of the seasons. It's a direct manifestation of your spiritual interaction with the natural environment, asking, drawing upon your own individual and group energies to harness the natural forces out there, the wind, the rain, the snow. Because we are exposed to so much of the scientific side of things, that part may get lost, the traditional part may get lost in the shuffle there or the explanations, but I think it's still very evident to a lot of people out at Hopi that we are who we are because of where we are. We wouldn't be Hopi if we were somewhere else. We pray for the moisture to come to provide the life-giving force to the crops that sustain us. To maintain that perspective, you have to maintain your connection to the landscape.
The American Indian Movement, or AIM, was originally founded in Minnesota by Dennis Banks and fellow Indians to address Indian sovereignty, civil rights violations, police harassment, and racism. AIM has been active in countless protests and encounters across America and has brought the plight of the American Indian to at least part of the greater American public. John Trudell was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1946 and became a Native American activist and spokesperson for the Indians of All Tribes takeover of Alcatraz in 1969. He founded Radio Free Alcatraz, and during the 1970s he served as chairman of the American Indian Movement. He passed from this earth in 2015. His daughter Tara Trudell characterizes her father and recounts a tragedy.
How would I characterize John Trudell? He was very enigmatic. He was very intelligent. My dad the one thing that I could never deny about my dad and being his daughter and seeing him among the people and hearing him among the people, and this is from when I was a child, that influence was that he loved his people very much, very much. That being said, that was probably one of the most powerful seeds he planted in me. The backstory is my father was a Vietnam veteran. He was taught that when you are in distress, one way to seek help or to let people know, you know, your fellow men is you hang a flag upside down. So it's a sign of distress. So my father, as a political statement, took a flag to the steps of one, I think it was BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, and protested the treatment of the indigenous people here in America, you know, being set up on reservations and also being assimilated into these cities where they were losing their identity and turning to alcohol and drugs. I mean, it was a very strong political statement that he made by burning the flag upside down as a sign of distress. Tragically and unfortunately, less than 14 hours later, Tina and her children, my brothers and sisters, and her mother and her father were trapped in a fire on Duck Valley Reservation. She was staying with her mother and father at this time, and she did that a lot while my father traveled. She smelled the smoke. She woke up, and she woke up her parents, and they tried to get out of the house, but because the house burned so quickly and so aggressively, it was an act of arson. They were locked in. They were not able to open any of the doors. Everything was almost like sealed shut, which is bizarre and tragic. So they all died in the fire except for Arthur Manning, her father, who at the very end threw himself through the living room window and suffered third-degree burns. But everybody else perished in that fire. The tribal police there in Duck Valley did a really small investigation and wrote it off as a fire that started on the back porch, which my father later on had it investigated with a private investigator who concluded that it was an act of arson.
What is happening at Standing Rock, North Dakota, and elsewhere lets us know that we stand at the edge of the abyss. Climate change is indeed a reality. We are losing species after species because of human folly. As Edward Abbey said in response to modern economics, growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. Today we've heard the voices of Charles Wilkinson, Shanto Begay, Edward Abbey, Dave Foreman, Roberta Blackgoat, Richard Groh, Lyle Balanqua, and Tara Trudell. Our theme music was performed on the guitar by Carl Bernstein. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February 11, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book entitled Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.